checked the rope he had tied there yesterday, slipped the noose around his neck, and jumped. It was that easy. The shock of the noose tightening filled him with cold adrenaline when Ron realized in horror that he hadn't tied the noose correctly. It was supposed to break his neck and kill him instantly. This would be slow strangulation. Standing at the foot of the stairs, David watched him thrash about with those pure white eyes and did nothing to help. Clawing madly at the rope, slowly crushing his windpipe, Ron managed to suck a sip of air into his burning lungs, then another, and another. He was going to live. Live. With excruciating slowness, Ron started to climb the rope, going hand over hand back to the stairs. That was last week. He was ready to try again. David had told him what he had done wrong, so he wouldn't fail next time. Not the rope more. That'll do the trick. Soon, he'd be asleep forever, absolved of his crimes. Oh God, please let me die this time. Mildred closed the journal and placed it flat on the table.
That's it. The rest is blank. Guess he finally did it.
Dean chewed a lip.
So he went mad from loneliness?
Mildred smiled sadly.
It's called cabin fever. Almost got it myself once.
His mental failure was completely understandable. Most crimes merely mutter their presence. Only murder shouts.
Doc had awakened in the middle of the reading and stood quietly by until Mildred was done. All of a sudden, Christy appeared at the hallway door, out of breath.
We're in. Lend a hand. We need some help moving the door.
Leaving the table, Mildred, Dean, and Doc joined the others and put their backs into forcing aside the massive portal to the bomb shelter. Digging in his heels, Dean was surprised at the weight of the door, until he saw it was only wood on the outside, the thin veneer covering a mammoth slab of steel and lead. Good camo. As the portal swung aside, air billowed out, smelling stale and dry.
Been closed tight for a long time.
Jimmy covered his face until the dead air dissipated. There was a cool breeze coming down from the open door atop the lighthouse, carrying the tangy smell of the sea. While Jack jammed a knife under the door to make sure it didn't swing shut, Ryan jacked the action on his Sig Sauer pistol and started down a short flight of brick stairs. In the enclosed space, the old lantern gave off a wealth of light, and the man could see the deactivated palm lock and keypad mounted on the wall, normally used to seal off the shelter from intruders. A grill at the bottom of the stairs was ajar, and Ryan followed the path of a zigzagging tunnel, very similar to the ones used in the redoubts. Rads can only travel in a straight line, and with a dogleg junction, once you stepped past the corner, you were safe. The tunnel opened onto a small room filled with stacks of crates and machines. The walls were lined with shelving packed with boxes and mysterious objects wrapped in vacuum-form plastic. Closed blaster racks were filled with military weapons, and tarpaulins covered large piles that could be anything.
Jackpot!
The silenced muzzle of the Sig Sauer sweeping the room ahead of him, Ryan strode through the maze of boxes, looking at everything but touching nothing. Doc stayed near the grill, a hand resting on the lion's head of his sword stick. Sometimes they found others waiting for them in a military supply dump. Secmen, muties that had sneaked in through the ventilation system, wild animals, and on a couple of occasions a sec droid. Almost unstoppable machines designed to kill unauthorized intruders. Warily, the companions spread out and started to hunt through the piles of supplies for specific items. Later on, they would do an inventory and decide what to take, but first and foremost, it was ammo and food. Everything else was secondary.
MRE packs!
Dean grinned in delight, going to a nearby shelf and pawing through a plastic box marked with the military designation for the long storage food packs. Prying off the lid, he felt another rush of trapped gas and started running his fingertips carefully over the assortment of foil envelopes, searching for even the tiniest pinprick or corrosion.
Perfect condition!
The boy happily filled the pockets of his jacket until they bulged. Snapping the pressure locks on a large plastic box, JB flipped off the lid and grinned at the M16 automatic rifles nestled in a bed of thick black-green grease. Another crate yielded an M60 machine gun, but upon closer inspection, there was a crack in the case, and the weapon was heavily corroded, especially its main recoil spring. As careful as if handling a bomb, J.B. closed the case and set it aside. The only way the M60 could handle its incredible recoil was to house an 18-foot-long spring. Once, long ago, the armorer had been trapped without ammo and let the spring fly loose just as a sticky was crawling in through a window. The coiled length went straight through the mutie and kept going for another 50 yards. A damaged M60 was a dangerous thing. Christie opened a sealed cabinet.
Ammo over here.
The interior shelves were neatly filled with a wide collection of different caliber ammunition. A lot of it was in 10mm, which they couldn't use. They often found the ammo, but never a 10mm blaster. However, there were a few boxes of the older 9mm rounds, and some civilian grades, probably stored here to trade with any survivors outside. Pushing aside the .44 caliber and .45 caliber packs, Christie discovered quite a lot of plastic-wrapped 5mm ammo blocks for a Heckler & Koch G12 caseless rifle. Ryan used to carry one, but gave it up because ammo was so hard to find. On a lower shelf behind some cleaning kits, she finally found some boxes of .357 ammo, whistled sharply, and threw one to Jack. The teenager made the catch and nodded in thanks. Going to another locker, Christie uncovered a staggering cache of .38 caliber rounds and took every box, stuffing her coat pockets full. Never had enough of this caliber. She, Mildred, and Dean used this. Jack, too, sometimes. Clearing some space on a workbench, Jack opened the cardboard box and reloaded his blaster on the spot. Then he tucked a few extra rounds in his pockets and put the rest in his backpack. Armed once more, Jack continued his search for clothing. Their pants and shirts were in tatters, underwear and socks always in short supply, and his left boot had a spot worn thin as a baron's promise. Unfortunately, he was only finding things like flak jackets, scuba suits, rain gear, and a lot of those computerized helmets that attached to the telescope mounted on an MR-1 rapid-fire blaster. JB had told him you could stick the blaster around a corner and see what was on the other side on a tiny vid screen suspended from your helmet. Then flip a switch and see in pitch darkness, or track an enemy by his body heat. Amazing stuff when it worked. But that tech required heavy batteries and all sorts of computer software, none of which they had ever found in any redoubt. Now where the hell were the boots? Heading directly for a large red cross on the far wall, Mildred found a small medical section, most of the chem in the bottles, only dust now. The latex gloves for surgery cracked apart from sheer age when she tried to put one on, and the rubber on a stethoscope was as brittle as glass. The frustrated physician located the MASH field surgery kit mentioned in the journal, stuffed in the fridge. She had hoped it would be in there. The refrigerator would make the morphine last longer, and even with the power off, the fridge should keep out most of the moisture and air. The med kit was almost identical to her own, except in much better shape, and Mildred immediately began transferring the contents of her old med kit into the new bag. Reaching a clear area situated before a steel desk, Ryan saw a complex radio wired to a nuke battery from a Hummer. Checking the dials, he found the batteries had been left on and were totally drained. Even those amazing devices had limits. It was a sobering thought. The radio would have been worthless anyway, but they might have been able to use the nuke battery to power some electric lights. Too bad. They often found wags, or at least parts of vehicles in the redoubts. No chance of that in a bomb shelter. He found a chem bathroom in the corner, next to a row of shower stalls carpeted with mildew, and a line of bunk beds attached to the wall, the pallets reaching from the ferro-concrete floor to the ceiling. These were accommodations for a full company of soldiers. Only a single bed was disheveled, but another was stripped, the mattress gone, leaving only the bare metal springs and frame. The scene of the crime, as Mildred would say. Following the power cables attached to the bare wall, Ryan soon located the generator, or rather, what was left of it. A tiny drip from a water pipe in the ceiling had slowly reduced the huge machine into a pile of rust over the long decades.
Never get those going again.
JB pushed back his fedora.
This isn't the prize we thought. Half this stuff is useless.
But half isn't. Any fuel in those tanks?
The armorer rapped on the side of a tank with a knuckle and got a dull answering thump.
Sure, lots. But it's diesel. Turned to jelly decades ago. Even if we got some to the gateway, it would be too thick to run the turbines. Need to cut it with something.
Shine?
Anything that burns would be okay.
Good. Save a gallon to take with us.
Ryan paused to let the throbbing in his leg ease.